This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1. I'm David Martin Davies. The award-winning podcast, This Land, just wrapped up season two last week. The 8 episodes investigates a series of custody battles that could have deep and wide implications for the rights and sovereignty of Native American tribes. At the center of it all is the Indian Child Welfare Act, and there are conservative groups that are seeking to have it declared unconstitutional. To find out more, I spoke with Rebecca Nagel, host of the This Land podcast.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Nagel. I'm a citizen of Cherokee Nation, living in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and the host and the writer of the podcast, This Land.
You're looking at the Indian Child Welfare Act and about conservative, attacks on this law. So first, you could tell us what the Indian Child Welfare Act is.
Absolutely. So the Indian Child Welfare Act, or often called ICWA for short, was passed by Congress in 1978, and it was in response to a crisis. So at that time, there was a big national survey that was done actually in the late 60s, and they found that 25 to 35% of all Native children had been removed from their families and tribes. And so some of that was done actually by the federal government itself, by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and a lot of it was done by local and state child welfare agencies that had racist policies that, you know, kind of assumed, you know, if you were a Native parent, you were inherently not a good parent. And so a lot of children were snatched from their families without a lot of explanation or due process for those parents. And so ICWA was passed in Congress, passed by Congress in 1978, and it really is kind of a set of guardrails. And so when a Native child, which is defined by a child that is either enrolled in an Indigenous nation or is eligible for enrollment in that nation, when an Indigenous child is either in the child welfare system or in the private adoption system, it's a set of guardrails to make sure that those custody proceedings don't go off the rails. And there aren't abusive practices towards parents or tribes. And its goal is to keep Indigenous children connected to their community.
That whole idea of adopting children, white Anglo families adopting children from Native American households, follows this long narrative in the United States. You know, we had Indian boarding schools, and there was this idea of civilizing Native people, and the idea that the best way to raise a child was this white Anglo-Saxon way of doing it. And it seems to be an outgrowth of that idea, which I think we now would, any reasonable person would think is totally inappropriate.
Absolutely. And there are subtle ways that logic, or maybe not that subtle, still shows up in these cases. So, for example, Chad and Jennifer Brackeen, they're actually from Texas. They live in the suburbs of Fort Worth. They're the lead plaintiffs in this case. And down in family court, down at the custody hearing, you know, they argued that they should be able to adopt a Navajo child over that child's blood relatives. And one of the reasons that they gave was that they had a bigger house and that they were worried that if this little girl grew up with her great aunt, that she wouldn't have her own bedroom and she wouldn't have her own privacy. And so, I mean, you just have to look at that. Her great aunt was actually a fluent Navajo speaker. She'd grown up in a Navajo speaking home. So actually, she's grown up with the Brackeens. And so you still see actually in these custody cases that are now, you know, the groundwork for this Supreme Court case, this really strong bias for white families and especially white families that are wealthy.
Now, in and of itself, that story is intriguing and needs to be explored. And there's a lot there. We're talking about children who are being taken away from their families, and we know that's always very emotional. But your finding in your investigation is that there is like a conservative movement, and it sounds kind of, you know, conspiracy theory. You know, here I got my board of all my connecting dots here, you know. But it's actually fascinating what you have found here about this effort, an organized, well-funded effort to dismantle the Indian Child Welfare Act. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it can feel like, oh, you know, get the tinfoil out. But whenever you look at any effort to get a case to the Supreme Court, you know, like I think one really important fact for people to keep in mind is, you know, this case didn't come out of nowhere. You know, in the past decade, the Indian Child Welfare Act has been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act. So, of course, it's well-funded, and of course, it's coordinated, just like any other effort, whether you're talking about, you know, climate change or abortion or immigrant rights. You know, if people are trying to make national change, they're getting funding and they're working together. And so because these cases are about children and because these stories kind of pull at the heartstring, a lot of other journalists kind of skipped over a pretty basic question of, you know, who is funding this and what's their reasoning? Why are they interested in this seemingly random law? And what we found is a paper trail that goes kind of back to the early days of this effort. That among conservative organizations, so like the Goldwater Institute really spearheaded it, and then other organizations have jumped on under the Goldwater's leadership, that it is not actually about children, that it was about building conservative state power through litigation. So is this idea about bringing strategic cases that would help build state power. And it's actually, I think, a really good example of how far that has gone and worked. Because, you know, it was a 40-year-old law in all of these efforts to try and get it overturned. They've just been kind of thrown out by the courts. But in Texas, where the state has done, where conservatives have really helped shape what the federal courts look like and who's on the bench, you had a really sympathetic district judge. He's the same guy who declared the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. He's also, you know, helped conservatives out on rulings on DACA and even like family leave for LGBTQ families. And then it went to the Fifth Circuit. And so this 40-year-old law that a lot of other courts have said is constitutional, you see these conservative-leaning courts in Texas rule in some pretty radical ways.
So, I mean, the question is, why would these conservative giants like the Goldwater Institute or the Cato Institute, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, why would they line up to try to take down the Indian Child Welfare Act? I mean, is it because, you know, they want to build pipelines through the middle of America and they can't do that because tribal land is there? What's the connection?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's important is that there are different players in the attack on ICWA. And I don't think all of the players came to the table for the same reason. And so what we found, the Goldwater Institute got funding from this conservative foundation called the Bradley Foundation. And what Bradley was interested in doing when it gave Goldwater seed money that kind of got this whole anti-ICWA effort off the ground wasn't actually about tribes or tribal sovereignty. They were just interested in building out conservative power through litigation and really just building the infrastructure for conservatives to be able to bring more lawsuits to change laws. And ICWA was just laying around and became a useful tool towards that. Where we found connections to the oil and gas industry is actually with a different group of people who are behind these lawsuits, which are the corporate lawyers. So litigation like this is really expensive. It is super expensive. So in a case almost a decade ago now, the attorney sued for attorney's fees, and it was in excess of $1 million. And so that's just one case. And so these cases wouldn't be possible without the corporate lawyers and the corporate law firms that are doing the work pro bono, you know, that are doing this really expensive federal litigation pro bono. And what we found is that those corporate lawyers and law firms also represent two industries that would really benefit from the way this case guts the rights of tribes and attacks tribal sovereignty. And those two industries are the gaming and betting industry and oil and gas. And just real quick, you know, for folks who are familiar with, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the fight at Standing Rock, the law firm that is representing Chad and Jennifer Brackeen, Gibson Dunn, they're the law firm that represented the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I think what's even more telling is that the constitutional arguments that are being made in this ICWA case to attack this law about Native kids, these lawyers have actually already used in cases to attack Native casinos. There's a states' rights argument and an equal protection argument, and both have been used by these lawyers in cases to attack Native casinos. And so they've already taken those constitutional arguments and transported them from casinos to kids. And so it's not that big of a logical leap to think, okay, if they can win in the arena of ICWA, then they can take those arguments back from kids to casinos.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the Indian Welfare Act and a complicated effort to dismantle it in the courts, which would weaken Native American rights. When we come back, how this relates to Texas politics, including the recent abortion ban. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This Land is an award-winning documentary podcast that tells the stories of Native American rights. The host is a Cherokee journalist, Rebecca Nagel. In season two, she investigates attacks on the Indian Child Welfare Act. I want to get to the Brackeen blog, and that is so rich of trying to have some understanding of what's really going on here. So explain what the Brackeen blog is and what did you find there?
Yes. So the story we're told about this case, and this is a story that's in federal court documents, that's in newspapers like The Atlantic and The New York Times, is that Chad and Jennifer Brackeen became foster parents. They took in this Navajo and Cherokee child. They had no idea about ICWA or that it would apply to this kid. And then they were blindsided when the law was applied.
Right. So that is the public story.
Yeah. And then what we found out on the blog was actually that when Chad and Jennifer became foster parents, their first placement was actually not a Native child. It was a 3-year-old boy that was so difficult, they actually asked CPS to take that child back. And when there was an opportunity to foster a Native child that was 10 months old, they were told at the very beginning, there was no possibility of adopting the child. And Jennifer agreed to the adoption because she thought it would be nice to have what she called an easy baby after having a difficult first placement. And she described it as a way to get her feet wet again. And so that was a pretty incredible discovery to find on the blog.
Right. So explain the contradiction and why that's important.
Well, their argument is that ICWA does not look out for the best interest of the child, because once a child has, you know, attached to a caregiver, like a foster parent, you know, it does irreparable harm for that child to be moved. But it really undermines that argument that they asked for a foster child to be moved and, you know, sent that first child back into the system. They fought to adopt a second child over that child's blood relative. And it was also a Navajo child. And they actually won custody of that child when the child had not been living in their home and they were not that child's foster family. And so it just doesn't add up. Like if the best interest of the child is the child staying where they are. There's one child that they fought for that for, but then there are two children that they asked to be moved. And so I think that once we got to the blog and we found all of the information of, you know, what they really had done as foster parents, that argument around the best interest really just unraveled, which I think is significant to the case, because that's part of the legal argument that they're making, is that ICWA not only discriminates against them as white foster parents, but it also discriminates against the native child. And so, you know, their version of the best interest is something that they themselves have not followed.
You draw lines saying that this case, Brackeen v. Holland, you say that there are connections to Texas politics.
Absolutely. And so you can understand how this case came to be by understanding Texas politics. And so there's a really, really important party to this case, and that is the Attorney General of Texas. And I think you could argue that if this case had just been brought by a group of foster parents, it probably would not be where it is today, waiting on the steps of the Supreme Court. But because you had states involved, and that effort was led by the Attorney General of Texas, you know, it was taken more seriously by the courts and gotten as far as it did. So backing all the way up to the beginning, when the Brackeens wanted to adopt that first native foster child, you know, they filed some petitions in family court and they were losing. And then what happened is this big corporate law firm that has a couple offices in Texas called Gibson Dunn and has a really strong working relationship with the AG's office. They got on board. They let the AG's office know about the case. And then in family court, in the custody trial, the Attorney General of Texas intervened. And I just want people to pause and think about that for a moment. Think if you were in a heated custody battle, or you were filing for divorce, you're doing the stuff that happens in family court, and the Attorney General of your state intervened. It's incredible. It's shocking. And so basically, once that happened, the Brackeens quickly won custody. And that's actually when the case started to move and go their way, is when they filed this federal lawsuit to strike ICWA down. And one of the things that's really important about Chad and Jennifer Brackeen is not exactly what happened in their case, but where they live. So they live in a very specific federal district where there's a judge called Judge Reed O'Connor. And, you know, Ken Paxton, you guys are probably familiar in Texas, has a little bit of a habit of filing federal lawsuits to try and strike down all sorts of federal statutes, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or the results of the 2020 election. And he really likes to take those cases to the courtroom of this one judge, Judge Reed O'Connor, because he is known to favor conservatives. You know, even the Wall Street Journal, which leans conservative, has accused this judge of going too far in his decisions. And so the Brackeens, because of where they live and because of Texas politics, were the perfect plaintiffs because they helped, you know, this effort to strike the Indian Child Welfare Act down. They helped that effort find the perfect judge. And Judge Reed O'Connor took the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is a 40-year-old statute, and basically chucked it out the window. And what's really important, I think, for people in Texas to understand is that all these folks are interconnected. So this corporate law firm and Gibson Dunn at Gibson Dunn and the Texas AG's office, when you look at their staff, there's kind of a revolving door. They swap staff all of the time. And they're also connected. They have these relationships with the federal bench. So Texas actually has this panel of conservative lawyers who appoint people to the federal bench in Texas. And the person who was running the Gibson Dunn's Texas office when Gibson Dunn took this case was on the panel that that nominated Mr. Reed O'Connor to the bench. And so those relationships between this law firm and the AG even extend to the judge that made that ruling. And I think it's really important for Texans to think about that. And what the connection to the abortion ban is you see in all of these other places where states have tried to ban abortion, it hasn't gotten past the courts. Time and time again, all these heartbeat bills haven't gotten past the courts. And it is not a surprise that Texas is the one place that it did, because Texas politicians have been working on creating a more and more conservative court system, you know, from Texas all the way up to the Supreme Court for more than the past decade. And so, you know, the kind of the very unique and odd trajectory that this anti-ICWA case has had, where every other court has basically thrown these cases out, is basically it's the abortion ban took the same path, you know, through the Fifth Circuit and then on up to the Supreme Court. And so I think that oftentimes, you know, when we think about laws, when we think about court decisions, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about how the sausage is made, so to speak. But, you know, when I think it's really important for people to understand that there are these relationships and also efforts that help shape the policies that affect our day-to-day lives.
Another player in all this is the media and journalists who have been covering this story. And unfortunately, many of the reporters have not been well equipped to understand the context and what actually is happening right in front of them. And that's because these well-funded actors who are trying to take down ICWA know how to handle the media. And I'm looking at a fact sheet that says key facts about ICWA for reporters. And it's loaded with these bullet points saying ICWA deprives children of the best interest standard. ICWA subjects Native American children to lower standards of protection. ICWA doesn't apply only to Indian children. ICWA is based on race, not tribal membership. It's just a lot of these points that, you know, a reporter can read this in 5 minutes and write a story thinking that they've done their job, but they're totally inadequate.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important when people make claims for journalists to investigate those claims. You know, so if I was talking to somebody and somebody said it's raining outside and another person said, oh, no, it's sunny outside, instead of quoting both of those people in a piece, it's my job as a journalist to go outside and see what's going on. And I think that it's really important to understand that the folks who say that ICWA is a bad law, that it harms Native children, they're not making that claim based on data. They're not making that claim based on what child welfare experts have to say. They're not making that claim based on what Native nations and tribes have to say. What they're saying, what they're using to make that claim are these anecdotes. You know, it's the story of what happened to Chad and Jennifer Brackeen. They're two other co-plaintiffs, two other non-Native foster families in the lawsuit. And so it's the story of what happened in these cases. And that's why I really wanted to get to the bottom of these stories and see, you know, do they tell a story about how, you know, ICWA has gone too far, or does it tell a story about what is still happening to Native families in our child welfare system? And so, like I said, there are three non-Native foster families who are plaintiffs in this case, and they wanted to adopt four Native kids. Brackeens have one custody of two. Every Native child had a blood relative that wanted to raise them. And every Native relative was told no, whether that no was from a social worker, a family court judge, every Native relative was told no. One child, her grandma was able to win custody. And that grandma had to fight the child welfare system for 3 years, and then the non-Native foster family that then sued for another 3 years. So it took her 6 years to adopt her grandchild. And so I think to look at these cases and say, it's unfair to Chad and Jennifer Brackeen. It's unfair to these non-Native foster families, when what's actually happened in the underlying custody cases is because these families have more resources. They have, you know, frankly, just more money. You know, Chad and Jennifer Brackeen have these extraordinary legal resources helping them out in family court. You know, the law firm that represents Amazon and Walmart, you know, stooping down into a custody case is just extraordinary. And because of that, you know, they won custody. And so I think it's more of a story about how money and power is determining where these children are being raised, rather than a federal law, and frankly, even state policy that also mirrors some of the preferences in ICWA that say that all foster kids are better off when they're raised with relatives. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a journalist can kind of go out, and a couple journalists have done that, you know, and interview Chad and Jennifer, or, you know, interview an expert at the Goldwater Institute and write that story, you know, maybe interview a Native leader too. But if you're not asking hard questions about what actually happened in these custody cases, what's happened is that a lot of the way that story has been told is simply factually inaccurate. And then And it's also, you know, an omission of information. You know, like there was a big story in the New York Times about Chad and Jennifer Brackeen trying to get custody of the second child that they were able to win custody of. That case is still under appeal in Texas. And it left out the fact that at the time the Brackeens were fighting for and winning and won custody of that child over that child's relative, they weren't fostering her. She was not living in their home. And so that whole attachment argument doesn't even apply, which I think is a really significant fact that was just left out of the article. And so, and then I think the other big thing that's happening with non-Native journalists is that folks don't understand federal Indian law. They just don't. They don't know what a federally recognized tribe is. They don't understand the parts of the Constitution, you know, the Supremacy Clause and treaties. They don't understand how the authority of Congress to pass laws like ICWA flows from those treaties. And so they're like, yeah, this treats Native kids differently than other children. That sounds right. And so I think that what the media has also done that has been detrimental is miss the bigger picture. You know, any other Supreme Court case, the media might tell, you know, might spend a little bit of time on the underlying story. But what that media coverage is going to focus on for the public is, here's what's at stake. You know, here's what this case is really about. And no $1 million custody dispute that has gone all the way to the Supreme Court is about who should raise a toddler. Right. And especially in this case, the underlying custody disputes, for the most part, have all been settled. So it's just literally impossible for this to be about the custody of a handful of toddlers. So then what's at stake? What are the legal issues of this case? And what it's really about is the unique political status of tribes. You know, ICWA only applies to children who are either enrolled in a tribe or eligible for enrollment. And there are a ton of laws, from reservation status to land rights to water rights to Indian gaming to healthcare, that treat tribes and tribal citizens differently than other people. And so if ICWA is unconstitutional because it's based on race, well, what about the hospital where I go and get my dental work done? Is that unconstitutional? Because if you're not a tribal citizen, you can't be seen at that hospital. What about the fact that my tribe has its own police force and its own court system? What other quote unquote racial group in the United States gets to have its own separate court system? And so, you know, these ICWA cases, what they really are, is sort of like pulling on a thread on a sweater. And if they can pull this thread far enough with ICWA, then it can be the beginning of unraveling the whole sweater. And that's really what this case is about. And that's kind of the ball that the media has really dropped, because I think, frankly, most journalists just don't understand enough about the unique area of federal Indian law to break that down for their listeners or for their readers.
Rebecca Nagel is the host and writer of the This Land podcast. It just wrapped up season two, which investigates conservative efforts to gut the Indian Child Welfare Act. She says there will be update episodes for the season as news develops, possibly in the spring when there are developments at the U.S. Supreme Court. When we come back from the break, we are live with Monica Martinez. She was recently awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for her work uncovering the troubling truths about state-sanctioned violence against Mexican Americans in South Texas. If you have a question or a comment for Monica Martinez, you can call our voicemail line 210-615-8982 or send a text message to 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. Okay.